The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I am honored to join you this evening. Following the book talk and presentation, we will have a Q&A. Please submit your questions anytime using the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. And now to introduce our guest. Moral, political, and social questions pervade Barbara Kingsolver's many works of fiction and nonfiction, including The Poisonwood Bible, The Bean Trees, and The Lacuna. She has won a devoted readership and a raft of awards, including the National Humanities Medal and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. She last joined us at the Free Library with Unsheltered, a novel about crumbling structures, literal and societal, and characters facing the double-edged nature of being sheltered, meaning safe and sound, but also unworldly and unprepared. Science and advocacy for the natural world are recurring themes in her work. If there ever was an opportune time for one of our most esteemed writers to artfully render the importance of science, it is right now. She joins us tonight with her new poetry collection, How to Fly in 10,000 Easy Lessons. The screen is all yours.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here with you, even though here in this case is my living room. I thank you for inviting me back. I think that I've done an event for the Philadelphia Free Library every time I've been on a book tour in recent memory, because I really love what you do, and I believe in libraries and your library. So thanks for being there, for doing everything you do for the community that needs you more than ever right now. Thank you, Philadelphia Library, for the hard work that I know you're doing to address inequality and injustice, both outside and inside of your doors. And people of Philadelphia, I assume that first of all, I have to assume you're there. I have to use my imagination to trust that you're all there watching. But if you are mostly in Philadelphia, my heart is with you right now this week, as your city is burning with outrage, with grief, with sadness for yet another death of a young man. And what I want to do tonight is to try to bring you, as I'm hoping to bring the world through poetry, just a bit of a relief package, something I can put into the world that reminds all of us, in a world that's horribly divided, polarized across lines of class and culture and place and belief, to try to remind us of the things that we all feel together. We all experience grief in the same way. We all experience joy and wonder in the same way. And I think that's the reason poetry has called me back in these times, really not just this year, but for the last several years, I've been turning more and more to poets for the kind of comfort I need in these times, because poetry has that unique capacity to wake up your brain and also calm it down at the same time to quiet it. So last year, when I was thinking about what to do next, well, actually, over the last couple of years, poetry had been speaking to me so much that I thought this would be a good time for me to gather up all the poetry that I've been writing in recent years and send it out into the world as a collection. I had no idea it would be this world exactly, but I'm glad to be able to send this book into the world. And this is the book. It's very beautiful. I can say that because I had nothing to do with the packaging, except to say, yes, I like it. It's hard to get the light quite right. I'm very grateful to my publisher for honoring my poetry with this gorgeous package. And I'm going to read to you from this book for about, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and then we'll take your questions and we'll have a conversation. I can tell you a little more later if you're curious about sort of how this book came to be, but I think that I can tell you in general, it's probably the most personal work I've ever published, mainly because I tend to write poems without thinking at all of audience. I don't think about them even being published. I just write them. And so it really contains, it's a more spiritual book than I've published before. And it really contains the closest I've ever come to making a public statement of faith. And the title poem is really just that. It's my answer to those hard questions that our children ask us and that we ask ourselves about why we're here, what happens when we die, what's the point of everything. This is How to Fly in 10,000 Easy Lessons. Behold your body as water and mineral worth, the self-same water that soon, from a tree's way of thinking, soon will be lifted through the elevator hearts of a forest, returned to the sun in a leaf-eyed gaze, and the rest, all wordless leavings, the perfect bone-white ash of you, light as snowflakes, falling on updrafts toward the unbodied breath of a bird. Behold your elements reassembled as pieces of sky, ascending without regret, for you've been lucky enough. Fallen for the last time into a slump, the wrong crowd, love. You've made the best deal. You summited the mountain or you didn't. Anything left undone, you can slip like a cloth bag of marbles into the hands of a child who will be none the wiser. Imagine your joy on rising. Repeat as necessary. Thank you. It's the hardest thing about virtual events is the dead silence after the end of a reading. But I trust you're there. The first section of this book is all how-to poems, and they're very practical things, of course, like how to fly, how to do absolutely nothing. Excuse me. Isn't it funny these days when you have to really apologize for every cough? Just have a little tickle. As I said, this book was entirely put together before any of us imagined a pandemic. And then early this summer, when we sent the manuscript out for to different, you know, magazines and publications, to choose, you know, one poem to run for what they call first serial rights, everybody chose this one. It ended up running in the New York Times, but somehow everyone thought this one was written for the pandemic. It was actually written years ago, but I think the truth is indelible and permanent, that no matter how terrible we think things are, they could be worse. So that's this poem, How to Survive This. Oh, misery, imperfect universe of days stretched out ahead, the string of pearls and drops of venom on the web, losses of heart, of life and limb, news of the worst. Remind me again, the day will come when I look back amazed at the waste of sorry salt, when I had no more than this to cry about. Now I lay me down, I'm not there yet. I'm gonna skip ahead. The book is divided into sections, and one section is all poems for, it's all eulogy poems, poems that I've written for beloved dead, my beloved dead, people I've lost over the years. And part of that is because I'm the person in my family who is nominated to write and read a poem at the funeral. So I've done that quite a lot. And of course, not all of them are, you know, have a universal value that sufficient to their, you know, inclusion in a book, but a lot of them did. And I really, you know, I was of two minds about including a whole section of dead people poems in this book, again, not knowing that it would be a year when we have all lost people and we are surrounded by grief and memory of our dead. But I decided ultimately to include these poems because what struck me as I guess there are about eight or nine of them, and they're all really different. And what struck me was that there are so many, that first of all, that death is an important part of life. We don't in this culture, we're not allowed to talk about it very much. And there are so many different ways that death comes into our lives. And has value in our lives as we carry on. So I'm gonna read just a couple of those poems. The first one is called Burying Ground, because I think all of us have buried at least someone in the last 7 months. This cemetery is full of too much living. Leaves of grass exhaling under our polished shoes, trees too burnished with copper plate autumn, a sky too elated today to revoke a touch our skin remembers as kin, to cast a voice still in our ears into the hushed ground. And this air too much like breath, the children too wonderstruck with strange fortune in this ranging throng of cousins, their black skirts twirling like pinwheels over the stony lawn, bouquets of dark flowers hurled into sunshine, hearts full afraid of the asking price, too much for this day, if this is the end of the world. You might have noticed or might not have noticed that there was that poem had a lot of rhymes in it. I really love formal poetry, and there is some formal poetry in this book. There is a villanelle, there are some sestinas, and I was nervous about that initially because I think I feel like modern readers feel that formal poetry is corny or something. Maybe it's because we all, you know, memorized too much Christina Rossetti or read too much Dr. Seuss or something growing up to think of it as an adult form. But my British publisher and my British poetry editor was very reinforcing as she, you know, as I worked on the manuscript through several editions. And so she and a number of other friends who are poets advised me, why not do with poetry those things that only a poem can do? So there are shaped poems in here that that have a shape that reflects the theme of the poem and all that. And it was, I really enjoyed embracing formal poetry. And that poem I just read to you, doesn't have end rhymes, but it has internal rhyme, and each line is linked to the next line through an internal rhyme. And this one that I'm going to read to you it's actually a sestina, which means it has six line stanzas, and the final word of each line in a perfect sestina, there's a very strict way that the end of each line, the end word, the final word of each line is repeated. This is a little bit more of a loose sestina, but the each line ends with a word that will be repeated. So there's later in the poem. So there's this flow of repetition that I think reinforces the poem, which is about housework, and it's about a plate that was passed down in my family. It's more than 100 years old. It was a wedding gift to my great grandmother, and every time I use it, of course, I think about her. And so that's the poem. My great-grandmother's plate, and it is for Lily Auksher, who was born in 1881, died in 1965. New Year's morning, standing at the sink, watching new snow drift, I cosset a hope that this weather might persist, bundling a household of family into one more day as mine before the world calls us out again. It whitens the woods while I weather a washing up from last night's happy ending. The grass-stemmed goblets, dorsal spines of underwater forks, and last, the white china platter with lattice edges, a gift to my great-grandmother for her wedding. I use this plate because I want to know how it might make me one with her, my hands slipped into hers like a pair of gloves as I lift and admire its fragile rim, sharing our standing as householders, dutiful washers of porcelain. But instead, a presence from behind me takes my shoulders, and I feel her dread of a snow like this for her new husband's sake, a man called out to cattle in any weather. Feel her brooding on a shuttered up morning for its cost in coal. This delicate wedding gift might plague her for the note her mother will be expecting soon, along with other good news. A washing up left for the morning would not have been her liberty. My hands may reach, but cannot share this porcelain gift. The newest stake of her household, the oldest one in mine. The next section of, I'm just giving you a little tour of the book, reading a little bit from each section. The next one is, it's called Walking Each Other Home, and it is all poems for about the ties that bind us, family and friends, the people who get us through hard times. And I'll read you this poem called Walking Each Other Home. Sorry, that's my dog. If you hear the sounds of home, that's because that's where we are. Walking each other home. My friend lives on this road, the same as me, two hollows down, two gladed mountainsides, briar patches that go without saying, fields in pumpkin or hay or fallow, once we can never forget, a bear. And once, for too long a season, a road-killed deer whose return to dust we both watched, the ragged pelt dried to leather, the shipwreck of ribcage. My friend alone saw the bear and told me of it the winter of her chemo. I was the one to see the deer, fresh struck, and had to find words, though even now I can hardly bear to say how I watched hooves beating air, reaching for some blind heaven. Between us, we know this map by heart. I walk from my house to hers, and then together we speak of things, or don't. We are often quiet. All the way back home to mine, or she walks here first, collects me for her return. Either way, this is the road where we live. Always we walk each other home, and always we walk some of it alone. Looking at the time. Okay, we're doing well. The next section is called Dancing with the Devil, and it is poems about art, poems about writing and reading and what art does for us. Sort of meta poems here, poetry about poetry, but hopefully entertaining and sometimes lighthearted. This one, but I thought I should read this because it's about reading, and this is, here we are in a virtual library. So this is called Thief. I read Dickens by dim lamplight, casing the joint for plots. This will not be a holdup, no clearing out whole cash drawers into my bag, just a shoplifter's itch. I'll take the convict benefactor, the woman who knits rebellions into my pockets. Wolf, that's with two O's, Virginia Woolf, I read in my room behind a locked door where she commands me to empty out everything, like airport security, nothing. Walk naked through the passage, but quick as life, I swipe her badge, make off with her authority. Emerson, Shelley, Dylan Thomas, HD, I read with my face planted, belly to earth. Leavings of the infinite composting in my rib cage, sun and rain on my back, bringing up a pelt of new grass. The last section of the book is called The Nature of Objects, and it is all poems that were inspired by natural things, natural beings, other species. They're important to me. They're important to you too. We don't always think about it enough, but every breath we take was recently inside a leaf. Every chair we sit on was at one time a tree. Likewise, the books that we read are made of the macerated hearts of trees. And it's not just about what they can do for us. It is about the interconnectedness of being on which we fully depend. We're just like every other species in that we like our own kind the best. We're pretty blind to everything else. It's interesting to me that people talk about, most people live in cities now. We have as a global population moved from mostly urban to mostly rural. So most people spend their days completely surrounded by human-made objects and think of that as the world. And if they do go and visit nature, they think of it as a thing, you know, a place to go and visit and then come back to the real world. But that in fact is the real world. We are one of millions of living kinds on this earth. And we're not alone in our egotism, our blindness to other species. I mean, there's a Carolina wren that every morning of the summer perches on the gutter right outside my bedroom, and he sings this song, and I know his song is, "This is my place, I own this thing, this whole territory is mine, babes come and visit," you know, and he's not thinking of me, he doesn't think this is my house, it's his house. So I get that we're all kind of hardwired to pay the most attention to ourselves, but we humans have such magnificent imaginations, such big brains, and such a capacity to alter our world in such a selfish manner that we are outliving our own possibility of inhabiting this planet. And that has never been more true than in the last 4 years. I think that we've all been paying a lot of attention to the ways that our nation has become a place of people hating people, people damaging people, people being damaged by ill will. What has slipped by mostly unnoticed is the damage that our nation has wrought on the rest of the world in ways that are coming to be almost irreversible. And just to give you an example, today, the U.S. government opened up the Tongass National Forest. You probably know, or you might not know where that is. It's the coast of it's the part of Alaska that comes down the coast along sort of the west coast of Canada. And it is, there's an enormous primary forest there. And today, the U.S. government opened 9 million acres, that whole forest, which belongs to you and me. It's a national forest. It was given to loggers. It was the whole 9 million acres of primary forest was opened for logging, open for business. Some deal was cut for somebody. That was today. I can hardly bear it. What I can do about it and what you can do about it, because a lot of you live in Pennsylvania, is please vote. That's all I'm gonna, no, it's not all I'm gonna say. You probably have, but if you haven't filled out that ballot, get it in there, that naked envelope, whatever you need to do, do it right. Put it in the drop box and then turn your energies to all the other people you know and all the people you don't know who haven't done it yet. Please, please, for the sake of this planet, please do that. I'm going to read you this poem called Great Barrier. It's about our failure to love across the divide between ourselves and others, the othering of all other species. Great Barrier. The cathedral is burning. Absent flame or smoke, stained glass explodes in silence. Fractal scales of angel, damsel, rainbow, parrot. Charred beams of blackened coral lie in heaps on the sacred floor. White stones fallen from high places. Spires collapsed, crushing the sainted turtle and gargoyle octopus. Something there is in my kind that cannot love a reef, a tundra, a plain stone breast of desert ever quite enough. A tree, perhaps, once recomposed as splendid furniture. A forest, after the whole of it is planed to posts and beams and raised to a heaven of earnest construction in the name of Our Lady. All Paris stood on the bridges to watch her burning. Believing a thing this old, this large and beautiful must be holy and cannot be lost. And coral temples older than Charlemagne suffocate unattended. Bleach and bleed from the eye, the centered heart. Lord of leaves and fishes, lead me across this great divide. Teach me how to love the sacred places, not as one devotes to one who made me in his image and is bound to love me back. I mean, as a body loves its microbial skin, the worm, its nape of loam, all secret otherness forgiven. Love beyond anything I will ever make of it. Thank you. I think I'll read one more poem. This is, and then we'll go to questions if that sounds all right. Your silence, I will take for the fact that this is a virtual reading. This is the last poem in the book. I've actually never read it at a reading before, but tonight I'm moved to do that. And I'll tell you, just as background, I was lucky enough to get to go to Australia, and I swam the Great Barrier Reef, which was inspiration for the poem that I just read you. Much of it is still alive and beautiful, and of course, much of it is dying because of climate change, because warmer air makes acidic oceans, which kill ultimately everything living there. So I had a list of things I wanted to see in Australia, and they're not, I was trained as a biologist. I'm a nature nerd and a biology nerd. And I have always been fascinated by the fact that once upon a time, all of the continents were one, and the flora of this continent of Gondwana land was all, you know, one big forest, and then it broke apart. And Antarctica used to be, of course, a part of that, and it had forests on it. And there's a particular kind of tree called Antarctic beeches, which originally were Antarctic trees back when, you know, there was a forest there. And there's a relic of this forest that's thousands of years old, individual trees, thousands of years old, up on this high escarpment, this big mountain that you have to climb in the Great Dividing Range of Australia. And I was going to see those beaches, and it was a big endeavor, but I climbed up there and I saw those trees, and I was moved beyond, it was a religious experience. I was moved beyond words. Well, ultimately, you know, I always find words, but I was powerfully moved by the age of those trees, and also derived great hope from the age of those trees, thinking about everything they've seen in their time, because trees do see and they do know, they in their own way, and they speak to each other, they communicate. And I mean, this isn't crazy stuff, this is science. They communicate chemically. And just being there among them made me feel so small and so insignificant, which is really a comforting thing. When you think of humans as potentially lethal creatures, it is good sometimes to understand our smallness. So this is the poem, Forests of Antarctica. From here, the oldest trees will speak to one another in the oldest language. Chemical breath, touch in darkness, rootlets seeking rootlets, holding hands underground for succor. And I could pass among them hearing nothing, or I could pause on the tilted light of slate-scrabbled path in a silence of moss and try to fathom their stillness. How nothing stirs their hearts. How patience is a promise a seed makes to its ground. From the day of cracking and rooting in, clinging to this escarpment, since before the trial of Socrates, before the tilting up of plinths at Stonehenge, already ringed with moss and age when Jesus walked out of Nazareth. Betrothal of these giants to their place has left them crouched on buttressed trunks high above the ground, leg roots exposed by all the rains that have washed the earth out from under them since the beginning. Everything has already happened here. Still, the ancient beeches hold their ground with moss-knuckled toes, remembering a Gondwana land of their youth when faraway Antarctica was yet a forested nation. Standing shoulder to shoulder, they braced for the breaking apart of the known, a rumbling violence of stones, mountain dashed against mountain, two ships parting. The trees exhaled in communion, rode their new continents, survived the end of one world. In the great dividing range, I crave to repent. In filtered tree fern light, I confess the sins of my tribe. We worship the future, demean the past, pay no mind to the present. But a future, cut off from the promise of ever joining history, lies already dead on its altar while we chew on our own restless feet. What's to become of our own seeds and betrothals? All these floss-haired children inside us that want to live, want to move, stay, eat the soil from under the house, move on. Want to hold fast, but cannot hold still. I am lifting them up as newborns to the nursery window, looking out on the forests of Antarctica. I tell them, this is your home. Tell them, none of this is yours. Do not believe as I did. When the world breaks open, fall apart with her entrails, fall with the stones or fly. Let the crush of it make you into some new thing, not yourself. See how these trees take the teat of the world and suckle it, drinking time, knowing it is perfect with or without them. Lacking their religion, you will have to make your own. You are the world that stirs. This is the world that waits. Thank you. I'm getting a little applause here. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I guess we're ready for questions now.
We are ready for questions. I want to let you know that your audience is with you. They are here. And on behalf of everyone, I so appreciate that reading. And just a reminder, last time you visited us, there was a very long standing ovation. And no doubt there would have been one tonight as well.
Thank you.
So our first question is from Katie. You mentioned that this is a collection of poems you've written over many years. What was the process of deciding which poems to include and which to leave out? Did you have any favorites that didn't make the cut?
That's a good question. It was first of all, a kind of a surprise to me that the book would be published at all. I've always loved poetry as a reader and as a writer. It was actually the first form that I took seriously as a young writer. But then I discovered that no one really pays you to write a poem or to write poetry. Poets generally, not generally, always have to teach or, you know, go around giving readings and do other things to make a living. And it was a great surprise to me that after I wrote a novel, I got this big check. Well, it seemed like a big check at the time. And I looked at it and I said, if I'm really frugal, I can live on this for a year and write another novel. And so I became a novelist by profession. And I know that's not exactly what your question was, but I'm getting to it. I guess I'm kind of answering a question that a lot of people have asked, which is, you know, we thought you were a novelist. What's the deal with poetry? And the deal is, I always wrote it, but didn't really. And I published a collection of poetry in 1992. And since then, I've been writing poems, but not really expecting, not thinking much about their publication. And that's why my poetry tends to be much more intimate and more personal than my other work, because I'm just doing it for me. It's not like it's therapy. I don't mean that. It's not like a journal or something. I mean, I craft poems as poetry, but I do them without a lot of thought to their marketing or whatever, if you see what I mean. So I had these poems, and last summer I had a conversation with my editor, Terry Carton at HarperCollins, who said, well, you know, I'd finished Unsheltered and finished the tour. She said, well, what are you working on now? And I said, well, I have three books that could be next. One is a novel, one is a collection of essays, and I also have all these poems, but I know you don't want to publish those. I mean, that was what I said. I thought, no, I don't want you to do this as a favor. She surprised me. She said, I would love to to publish your poetry. So it was a little bit of a shock to bring all these poems out of a drawer and first winnow through them and find, you know, sort of first decide which ones. I mean, all of them, of course, would need to be revised because that's what you do when you're preparing a book. You make everything, you know, as perfect as you can. Some of them were vestigial, some of them were more or less, you know, finished. But First, without even thought to organization, I pulled out the ones that I felt had the most universal value. As I said earlier, the whole collection of elegy poems I set aside. I thought, I don't really know if these belong. Some were extremely intimate, very revealing about personal, my relationship with my mother, for example, which I've never, ever written about. But my mother died, is no longer living. And that gave me a kind of freedom to think, well, this might be, you know, a time when I could publish more of this kind of more personal work. If I feel that it's also universal, if I feel it speaks to other people in a valuable way. So that was my first. And so I've already told you that there's a poem about the death of my mother that I was not going to include. But some people saw it and said, no, this needs to be in the book. So there's a long poem about fairly, when I say long, it's like three pages long, about that was written in your city. After I got a terrible review it was devastating. And I went to a museum to try to just be comforted by art. And I ended up having this conversation, like in my mind, with a painting. And it ended up being this whole conversation about how art never dies and how art is much more important than the critic or the artist or anything else. It's about the conversation that happens between the reader and the writer, the artist and the viewer. So that one I wasn't sure about. There are several others that I was very uncertain about. Oh, there's one called How to Do Absolutely Nothing. And I thought, who wants to read this? So I put a lot of poems in that I had doubts about and ended up including them because I was encouraged to do so. And I have to say that every poem that the poems I worried most about, I've already heard from people with the sentiment that those were the most useful to them. They were the favorites. They were the favorites. Those poems were their favorites. So I think it's not it's not a new observation that the things we do that feel riskiest to us as writers are often the most rewarding to readers.
Thank you. Does the framing on the page of This Is How They Come Back to Us represent the simultaneity of time in memory?
Yes. Good observation. That's a kind of a shape poem in a sort of limited way that it's right. I guess I could show it to you if you have the book. Here it is. I don't know if you can see. It's right justified. Normally, you know, poems are left justified, or anything we read is left justified. It all starts in the same place on the left and ends, you know, like here, there, or everywhere on the right. This is the opposite. The end point, because it's a poem about the ways, all the different fragments of memory we have when we look back on a person and how the whole, it's all there at once, the end and the beginning. That's the end of the poem. All these parts, it's about remembering my grandfather. All these parts of his life are equal now, the end and the beginning. And what I was suggesting with the shape of the poem is that these memories start at many different points, but they all end at the same place, which was death. So somebody was on the ball there. Thank you for noticing. And of course, when I turned that in, the editors thought, this was a mistake. You meant this left justified, right? And I said, no, sorry.
I do miss our smart audience, that's for
sure.
That's
right.
Two questions. These are from Julie and Martha, saying a similar thing, which is, who is your favorite poet? And also, are there any poets that particularly speak to you in these current times?
There are. There are many poets I love. I love to read poetry at the end of, I love for poetry to be the last thing I read before I go to sleep at night, because I think of it as flossing the word loving parts of my brain. And I go through sort of spells of different favorite poets. Mary Oliver is always, always my friend. She's always a comfort to me. I love Lucille Clifton. I think her poems are especially relevant in these times, because she wrote, I kind of hate that word domestic, because people think of it as condescending, but it's not. The immensity of the world within the home, within the family. She raised 6 children, and her poems are short because, and I heard her say this in a reading, that's about as many lines as she could hold in her head until the end of the day when she got to write. So her poems about family and home and just the small sphere, I think is really valuable right now when we are all learning to make more out of less, to find contentment with what we have. So who else? I love Emily Dickinson for the same reason. Here was someone who self-quarantined for 26 years, the last decades of her life. She never left home. And she found the world and wrote about it and brings it to us. I love Claudia Rankine. I love Nikki Giovanni, who I think was just there. I love, did I say Dylan Thomas? I could read Under Milkwood just on continuous loop because of the way his use of language. The list goes on and on, but those are some favorites.
If you were in the auditorium and said that poetry is like flossing the word-loving parts of your brain, you would have received a round of applause. Well, this question is from Suzanne. I hear a lot lately about how writers and artists and musicians should use their craft and talent to discuss social justice issues. What are your thoughts on that responsibility? Responsibility, in quotes.
I don't think there's any should. I think each of us decides what mood, you know, each good art comes from passion. That's the bottom line. What moves us will get us to our desk every day, or our easel, or our musical instrument. And that's how we make good work, is getting to the desk and staying there and doing the work day after day. So I've always been moved by the things that worry me most, which end up being, you know, issues of justice, of power, and unequally distributed power and resources, divisions of class, of gender, abuse of the natural world. These things have always worried me ever since I was a kid. Those are the things that that move me when I read about them. I guess because that's the real world as I perceive it. So to me, the platform carries a responsibility of taking seriously that I'm asking people to give me their time. You know, you have many other things you could be doing. And so if I'm going to bother you with, you know, with a poem, or even more so a novel, you know, if I'm saying, give me 10 hours of your time, I want to give you something back that matters, not just the opportunity to have forgotten your own life for 10 hours, which might be, you know, what you get from like streaming, I don't know, Bob's Burgers. I don't know. I don't want to single out anything as pure entertainment, but I feel like I have a responsibility to take this platform seriously and address the real world and the things that I see as significant. And I also think that if, as long as I can imagine a better world than this one, and if I can have a conversation with you about that, then I want to do that. But it's not mine to say anyone else what any other artist should do. I will tell you this though, the world over, people in most societies look to their artists as the bellwethers of social change. If you look at, you know, artists, writers in Latin America, writers in Africa, if you look at who's won the Nobel Prize year after year after year, they are always artists that we would call political. And it used to be so here too. John Steinbeck, for example, was considered a very important and serious artist who wrote about issues of class and social justice. That changed in the 1950s when we had the McCarthy witch hunts, and there was a scouring of politics from art in this country in a devastating way. A lot of artists lost their livelihoods, it's a kind of cultural genocide. It's like when you wipe out a generation, that doesn't just pop back up again. It has taken us half a century to recover from that. So it's really only in the last half decade, I think, that we're again starting to feel free to celebrate art and politics. And I'll remind you that I've been writing for 30 years. And I'll tell you that for the first 20 years of that career, I was continually scolded for being a so-called political artist because somebody had decided that wasn't allowed. I never thought of myself as a political artist. I think of myself as an artist. I think about craft. I just try really hard to make my work good work, but the material I address tends to be real world based on problems. So it's been very interesting to me to see as I become a silver-haired writer, I see that disapproval that I kind of had to weather for decades is starting to lift. And I'm so happy for younger writers who are coming up in these times, but they still need our support. It's still not easy because there's always, you know, with publishing a concern about, will this be marketable? You know, do people really want to read about difficult things? The answer is yes, but we need to convince that with our dollars. So please support the artists you like by buying their books, and please support your library, and also support your independent bookstores as much as you can, because they desperately need you right now. If you want this country to have one retailer only for everything, with a name that starts with A, then sure, go ahead and buy your books and your shoes and your whatever, coffee filters and everything from there. But if you care about democracy and freedom of information and ideas, please support your libraries and your independent bookstores. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for saying all of that. A few questions about your writing process. I'm going to try to combine them. Okay. What is your everyday writing process and how has it changed during the pandemic? And does your writing process differ from when you're writing poetry than when you're writing a novel?
It does. Yeah, that's several questions. I'll start with the pandemic. Look, I'm a professional introvert. I like going into a room, closing the door, and spending the whole day with my imaginary friends in my head. Especially as a novelist, you have to really be comfortable. You have to love your own company. You know, you have to be very comfortable in a room by yourself, really. And it's funny because it's not even about loving your own company. You forget that you have a you. I mean, when I'm writing a novel, I forget that there is a me. I just go into that other world and I stay there. And it's solitude. What you have to love is solitude to do this, you know, most of your waking hours, day after day, month after month, year after year. So I was pre-adapted for the pandemic. My work schedule itself has changed very little. I get up in the morning and I get to my desk as much as I can, as quickly as I can, and stay there as long as I can because I love to write. As a working writer, one has to do many other things. You know, just like you wouldn't believe how many other things. And so I try to sort of, I have an assistant who takes care of a lot of that stuff. And we, you know, meet for lunch every day. And she goes over and asks, you know, do you want to speak to the garden club of blah, blah, blah? No, thank you. You know, just like all of these requests that come in. But a lot of, you know, I mean, I don't traipse around and talk a lot because that's not what I do. I'm a writer. But there are a lot of other requests that, you know, that I do gratify, and assignments that I take, and things, people that I help out, and all this and that. I established a prize and I help administer that. So I do all those other things, but what I love is to write. And I've always really been jealous of I've jealously guarded my writing time because I've been a mother exactly as long as I've been a professional novelist. The same day that I brought home my first baby from the hospital, I got my first contract for The Bean Trees, my first novel. So bam, it happened like that. And I had to learn quickly that, like any working parent, I can only work when my children they're grown now. I could only work when they were in someone else's care that I had to pay for out of my meager earnings as a starving artist. So, you know, I developed habits of great efficiency. I always said my muse is the school bus. It takes them, I go, I work. I don't need to, you know, get in the mood. I just go to it. And even though my kids, as I said, are adults now, I still work that way. As if the school bus was going to bring them back any minute and I would have to stop and go put the lasagna in the oven. So that's that. I mean, what has changed is book tour. Normally, beginning every going to Philadelphia and going to UC Santa Barbara, where I was, you know, yesterday, and coming home exhausted. So this is really much nicer. I worked on my novel all day today, and then I snapped out of it, made a cup of tea, and I came to talk with you. So if you like this kind of book touring, I do too. I hope it will stick. I mean, of course, there's much to be said for, you know, of course I miss personal interaction. And as I said, it is really weird to read to a complete silence. I do love getting feedback, but I also think that we are all learning of necessity that there are many other ways to be together that are more efficient of our time and, more importantly, more efficient of our resources, so we're not burning jet fuel every minute for things that we don't necessarily need to do in places we didn't really have to go. So I think there are a million ways that this time is teaching us that a lot of the things we thought we needed, we maybe didn't really need. And a lot of what we want, we maybe already had. This is not to say, this is not to overlook the devastating losses of people, of employment, of security and safety. And I'm terribly sorry to all of you for everything you've lost. I've lost people too. But I live in a beautiful place where I'm happy. I'm really lucky that I'm not closed in a little apartment with, you know, with toddlers or something. And so I don't mean to sort of to overlook the difficulty of this time, but I think very little good comes out of complacency. And these have been times of no complacency. So that's my thinking.
All right, we have time for just one last question. It's difficult to choose. How does your process for writing poetry differ from writing a novel?
Ah, that's the part of that last question I didn't answer. Thank you. It is a good question. It feels different. It's sort of, I would compare the difference of the process of writing a novel versus writing a poem to the difference between a marriage and a fabulous first date. One is a commitment, you know, a novel, you get in there and you're in there for years and you have to make it work. And sometimes the people in there aren't getting along and you have to put everybody through therapy. You just have to keep pushing. And I mean, I do love writing novels, but it's also, in sickness and in health kind of thing. It's a long-term commitment. Whereas a poem will occur to me usually sort of in a flash of insight. I feel like the genesis of a poem is often realizing two previously unacquainted things might kiss, you know, and kind of blow up, you know, the neurons of happiness in your brain when you realize, wow, those two things have come together in a way I never thought they could come before. So when I see those two things and I see how I might make them kiss on the page, I'll sit down and try to draft that out. And if it's working, like as I said, a fabulous first date, it's all fun and this is cool and this is great. And if it's not working, then I get up and say, okay, bye, done. That's not to say, of course, that I finish a poem in one sitting, but I'll often draft a complete poem in one sitting, come back to it another day, usually take half of it out because I tend to write long. The poets I admire most are the ones who write really short poems, and they're perfect, you know, and I'm always wanting to do that. For this book, my goal was to get every poem on one page, and I almost did. There are a few that needed to be longer. And then there's one that's supposed to be like, it's a long prose poem. It was meant to be longer, but usually I end up taking, you know, sort of cutting down to the bone. And then I see where it stands. And then, you know, and of course it's all about the language and listening to the insides of the words and thinking about the connotations of the words and kind of what's the difference between fixed and mended, you know, and how do these words get along with the words on either side of them and the ones in the following lines. And so, you know, hearing the sounds of the words and tasting them. I just love all that. I just love playing with words. And poetry is really the greatest distillation of craft. So I find that really gratifying, really fun. And with this book, I had whole days where I just would work on the book, you know, getting it and sort of thinking about editing it and placement and all that. Generally, a poem will just be, you know, an afternoon affair, you know, and then I'll come back to it on another afternoon while I'm writing other things. Now, when I go through spates of writing poems, when I'm writing a novel, a lot of what would be poems end up going into the novel. It's just, you know, because a novel starts when I'm really into a novel, it just absorbs everything. It's like this black hole, you know, everything I see or think or hear or dream somehow finds its way. You know, it becomes shaded with meaning and I see how to slice it in and how the language can elevate, you know, this scene or this chapter. So my novels, I have to tell you, have cannibalized hundreds, if not thousands, of poems, but that's okay too, because there's a place for poetry. You know, literary fiction needs to be made of poetry, really. The language has to be poetic. So that's okay. And we can, you know, we can forgive those novels for the poems that they've eaten. But it's also nice in between novels to attend to poems and let them live, you know, let them have lives of their own. So those are all such good questions. And I see it's past 8:30. So thank you for spending this hour together with poetry and libraries. And sorry for delivering a lecture about voting, but I know it's falling on, I know I'm preaching to the choir, right? But just make me feel better. Promise you'll get those ballots in and you'll maybe get some other people to get their ballots in. Nothing has ever been more important. And no, the one thing that's more important is that you remain hopeful. This is not a time to give up. We can't. So I'm going to close on a note of hope by reading a poem about this. Emily Dickinson, I love, of course, her poem about hope. She saw it as this bird that comes and perches in your chest, and it sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And I love that. And I can see that. But for me, it's not a bird. For me, hope is, it's not even a thing that I have. It's a thing that I do, that we do. It's something we make. And it's not a choice. It's a duty. It's an obligation, because when we stop being hopeful, we turn our backs on the world. The world that will go to hell in a handbasket, and we turn our backs on all the kids who are going to have to live in it. And that's immoral. It's not doable. So how do you keep it up? You just do it. It's like an engine. You get up in the morning and you tinker with it till you get it running, and it's going to peter out by the end of the day, which is fine. You go to bed, you get up in the morning, and you just get that hope going again. So this is my poem that I want to leave you with, How to Be Hopeful. Look, you might as well know this device is going to take endless repair. Rubber cement, rubber bands, tapioca, the square of the hypotenuse, 19th century novels, sunrise, any of these could be helpful. Also feathers. The ignition is tricky. Sometimes you have to stand on an incline where things look possible, or a line you drew yourself, or the grocery line, making faces at a toddler secretly over his mother's shoulder. You may have to pop the clutch and run past the evidence, past everyone who is praying for you. Passing all previous records is okay, or passing strange, just not passing it up. Or park it and fly by the seat of your pants. With nothing in the bank, you will still want to take the express. Tiptoe past the dogs of the apocalypse, asleep in the shade of your future. Pay at the window. You'll be surprised. You can pass off hope like a bad check. You still have time, that's the thing, to make it good. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for joining us tonight. And I thank you to all of you out there, wherever you are, for joining us as well. Have a nice evening.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.